Irony intrigues me. Irony is just, it's really interesting because irony elicits all kinds of different types of emotions, whether we're talking happy or sad. I mean, irony just, it intrigues me. Things are just ironic and they just grab my attention. And there's something about irony. I mean, it can come in all different shapes and sizes. It can come from videos. It can come from photos. But the bottom line is, irony just intrigues me. It ropes me in. And some of you right now understand that irony isn't just limited to videos or photos. Sometimes irony can even happen in a moment. I mean, there's some of you that are sitting here right now going, this is a bit ironic. A sermon on obedience is being taught by the guy with the long-haired hippie on campus? Like, what? What's good? That's a bit ironic. And irony intrigues me. Because irony can come in moments when we don't expect it, or in ways that we don't expect. Irony can even come in a statement. A statement like this. Everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus. But no one really wants to go to where that road ends. I mean, everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus. But no one really wants to go to where that road ends. And I find that quite ironic.
You know, if I was going to use one word, if I only was able to use one word to describe Acts chapter 9 on the road to Damascus, I don't have a choice. I have to use the word irony. It's an incredibly ironic situation. I mean, just take this for example. You have Saul of Tarsus, who is so devoted to God, he is so zealous in his devotion, that he's even willing to go to Damascus in order to persecute and arrest Christians who are really the ones that are devoted to God. I mean, let that sink in for a minute. In his devotion to God, he's so devoted that he's going to go persecute the people he thinks that aren't devoted, but they really are devoted, and since they are devoted, he's not devoted whether he thinks he's devoted or not. I find that ironic. I mean, don't you? That's irony. Oh, but it doesn't stop there. As a matter of fact, Saul is on the road to Damascus. In Greek, he's on the hodas to Damascus. And in Acts chapter 9, verse 2, it doesn't say he's going to persecute Christians. It says he's going to persecute the group known as the Way, or the hodas. So let me summarize so far. In Saul's devotion, he's walking on the hodas to Damascus to persecute the hodas, who are actually the ones that are devoted to God. Irony. But it doesn't stop there. Because all of a sudden, in Acts chapter 9, verse 4, we see this blinding light comes. And this voice rains out. And Saul falls to the ground, and it says he falls, or pipto. We find the Greek word pipto another a couple places in Acts, but the closest one is in Acts chapter 5, where Ananias and Sapphira, pipto, they fall dead because of their rebellion. But where pipto is used in Acts chapter 5 to describe the judgment or the death of the rebellious ones, in Acts chapter 9, verse 4, it is going to be used to describe the event in which the rebel of Saul gets life. And did I mention that he receives the message of life when he goes to Damascus from a man by the name of Ananias? Irony. But it doesn't stop there. Acts chapter 9, verse 4, the red letters explode, and they scream out, and they say, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And ironically, Saul answers back with a really weird question. He says, who are you, Lord? And the voice responds with a name that I'm not sure if Saul and his companions would have been experiencing a moment of irony or a moment of great fear. Because the voice says, I am Jesus. and the light on the road to Damascus that will lead Saul out of darkness. And Acts chapter 9, verse 8, blinds him for 3 days. Irony. Everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus. But no one really wants to go to where that road ends. I mean, everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus, where the heavens come open, God speaks your name, Shane, and tells me exactly what I need to do. Everyone wants that experience. I mean, the road to Damascus reminds us of the burning bush, where the voice from the bush speaks out to Moses, and it says, I want you to go and set my people free. And it launches the ministry of Moses, where he has an exodus from Egypt. Everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus. The road to Damascus reminds us even whenever the heavens are ripped open at the baptism of Jesus, which launches him into his own ministry, where he has his own exodus, this time not from Egypt, but from sin. And boy, do we want our experience of the road to Damascus, don't we? I mean, everyone does. Everyone wants an experience like the road to Damascus. But no one really wants to go to where that road ends. And I find that quite ironic. Now, some of you may be sitting there thinking, like, hold on, hippie. Okay. I can't believe you keep saying that over and over. Of course I want to go to the end of the road to Damascus. Obviously, I'm at Ozark, aren't I? I'm on my Tuesday tour. I mean, I want to go to the end of the road to Damascus. I am willing to preach to anyone at any time. I'm willing to go to the ends of the earth. I'm willing to even be beaten for Christ. I am willing to be God's sacrifice for the gospel. So don't tell me I don't want to go to the end of the road to Damascus. But here's the problem. That's not where the road to Damascus ends. We assume that's where the road to Damascus ends. I mean, we assume the road to Damascus ends in these grand moments of ministry. We assume the road to Damascus ends in moments of mass conversions because of our prolific preaching. We assume the road to Damascus ends maybe even with grandiose stories where we fellowship in the suffering with Christ. But that is not where the road to Damascus ends. So where does the road to Damascus end? I'm glad you asked. Turn with me to Galatians chapter 1, verses 13 through 18. Because what we find in Galatians chapter 1 is Paul tells us through his own words, through his own experience, where the road to Damascus ends when his name was Saul. Galatians chapter 1, verse 13 says this. For you have heard of my previous way of life in Judaism, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tried to destroy it. Acts 8, anyone? I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. But when God, who set me apart from my mother's womb and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son. Acts 9, anyone? When God was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, my immediate response was not to consult any human being. That's not where the road to Damascus ends. I did not go up to Jerusalem to see those who were apostles before I was. That's not where the road to Damascus ends. He says, but I went into Arabia. Later I returned to Damascus, but I went into Arabia. Then after 3 years... After three years later, he says, then I went up to Jerusalem. Did you see where the road to Damascus ends? Did you catch it? Galatians 1 tells us very clearly that the incredible interaction with Elymas the sorcerer in Acts chapter 13 is not where the road to Damascus ends. Or the miraculous conversion of the Philippian jailer in Acts chapter 16 is not where the road to Damascus ends. Because the road to Damascus does not end on the Areopagus of Athens. The road to Damascus does not end in the amphitheater of Ephesus. The road to Damascus does not end in the Mamertine prison of Rome or at the cold axe of the Ostian Way. The road to Damascus ends in obscurity. And while many of us want the experience of the road to Damascus, none of us really want to go to where that road ends. And I find that quite ironic. Because, man, do we want the experiences of Paul's conversion. And boy, are we ready for the blessings of his ministry. And some of us are even willing to be beaten like Paul was beaten. But many of us aren't even willing to go and to sit in our rooms and study the Word of God for a while. So let me say a statement and as much heresy as I can possibly muster this morning. Some of you need to stop doing so much ministry and spend more time preparing in obscurity. Pope Gregory the Great, in 590 AD, he wrote the Book of Pastoral Rule. Anybody that wants to be in some sort of pastoral position of authority needs to read this book. It is incredible, the depth of wisdom. At the very beginning, though, Pope Gregory the Great in 590, he writes this. He says, "No one presumes to teach an art till he has first, with intent meditation, learned it." He says, "What rashness is it then for the unskilled to assume pastoral authority, since the government of souls is the art of arts? And yet, how often do men who have no knowledge whatsoever of spiritual precepts fearlessly profess themselves physicians of the heart, though those who are ignorant of the effect of drugs blush to appear as physicians of the flesh." In other words, some of you need to spend less time doing ministry and become more focused on preparing in obscurity. Some of you may be thinking, okay, that's it. Cross the line. Are you kidding me, Shane? You're going to sit up here and tell me not to do good things, not to serve, not to go to Missouri Southern? You're going to really tell me that I should stop doing those things? Really, that's what you're saying. You know what, Shane? That's not just an ironic statement. That's a stupid statement. No, it's a biblical statement. Because do you realize that almost every single person in the Bible that does anything of significance spent a substantial time in obscurity preparing? I mean, Moses wanders for 40 years in the desert before he ever sees a burning bush. David was a shepherd for years, way before he was a king in Jerusalem. I mean, even Jesus. 30 years of obscurity before his ministry launches. And yet many of us presume that we can skip the step of preparation and obscurity and dive right into leadership ministry. At this point, I don't know if the word I'm looking for is ironic or foolish. Because even at the risk of ridicule, I'm going to say it again. Some of you need to stop doing so much ministry and become more focused on preparing in obscurity. Because how you prepare will directly affect how you minister. I mean, why is it that 3 years is usually the average length of a ministry? Why is it that some of you that walk across the stage in just a couple of weeks will be out of ministry in 5 years? Why is that? Don't get me wrong, I understand there's loads of factors that come into the reasons why this happens. I get it. But I think one of the main reasons is because we want to skip the end of the road to Damascus. We don't want to prepare in obscurity. What we want to do is refuse to listen to the biblical examples that say in obscurity is where you grow in knowledge and in character to prepare you for the battle. And how you prepare will directly impact how you minister. And too many ministers don't take the time to prepare well. Believe it or not, this is a frustrating sermon. It's a sermon I've wrestled with quite a while, and I really don't like to have to say it, which is somewhat ironic. But what you need to hear me, and maybe let me just stop for a minute. Because I need to make sure I'm being very clear. This sermon is not anti-evangelism. This sermon is not anti-ministry. This sermon is not anti-Christian service. So if you take this sermon and you justify your laziness in serving the local church right now, you're not listening to me. If you take this sermon and you justify the exaltation of reason and logic over relationships, you're not listening to me. If you take this sermon and you justify perpetually staying in the state of obscurity at the end of the road to Damascus, you are not listening to me. Because this sermon is for the churches that were wounded by ministers that took no time to prepare well. This sermon is for the Ozark students that came here with so many good ideas of ministry, only to flunk out because they were convinced that doing other things was more important than preparing. This sermon is for the kingdom of God that is longing for soldiers to come out on the field with their weapons well prepared. This sermon is about obedience, even if it doesn't make sense. Because it's so unfortunate that obedience comes with so much negative baggage. I mean, we use the word obedience along with other cuss words like rules and regulations and commands. But what we don't understand is obedience is not an issue of completing tasks. It is not about following rules. It is about an identity. Obedience is about understanding who you are in comparison to the one that has given you the command. And frankly, some of us are just simply too arrogant to be obedient. You know, a Jewish rabbi was once asked this question. He said, "Why do you keep the dietary laws? I mean, why do you keep all the dietary laws, all the meticulous foods that you can and can't eat? Why do you keep the dietary laws?" And the Jewish rabbi looked back and he said, "I keep the dietary laws because I don't know what they mean." You see, for him, his obedience was not driven by the logical assessment of the practical benefits of the dietary laws. His obedience was not even driven by his desire to secure his salvation. His obedience was driven by an identity, because he knows more about the one who gave him the rules, and he's not really concerned about the rules he was given, because he understands it's about identity. The transformation from Saul to Paul is not possible. The transformation from Saul to Paul, from a violent persecutor of the faith to a nonviolent proclaimer of the faith, is not possible unless the heart begins to cry out, "Who are you, Lord?" Because in the blinding light of the road to Damascus, Saul understood what we oftentimes overlook. And that is, it is not so much about where he's telling me to go as it is the fact of the identity of the one that told me to go. Obedience is about identity. And whenever you realize the one that's given you the command, then even if it leads itself all the way to obscurity and preparation, you'll be content, because you know the journey with God has just begun. Some of you are sitting there thinking, "Whoa, this sermon is so weird." Like, "Shane, why are you preaching this sermon to me now? Like, we're graduating in just a couple of weeks. Like, the sermon, you know, the semester's almost over. Why didn't you preach this to me back in August, whenever I was descending into the abyss of preparation and obscurity, otherwise known as your 7 a.m. Matthew class? Like, I'm not understanding why you were preaching this sermon to me now." Well, the simple and straightforward answer is, this is when they scheduled me to preach. But there is another answer. There is another answer. Because if you know the story of Saul, you know that the end of the road to Damascus was not the end of the story. If you know the story of Saul, you know that the end of the road to Damascus was the beginning of a journey. Because after the road to Damascus, after the end of the road to Damascus, Saul will go on many other roads. Roads like that of the road of Nain, where he ignites a compassion in Saul. Roads like that of Jericho, wherever he is disciplined and whenever he has his faith even challenged. Roads like that of Jerusalem, where even in the face of suffering and persecution, Saul resiliently rejoices. Why? Because you will be prepared for the roads that you travel if you go and spend the time at the end of the road to Damascus. Here's the truth. I don't know what road you're about to travel. I don't have a clue what road you're about to travel. I don't know if you're about ready to walk down the road through the Garden of Gethsemane where you will have to stare evil in the face and glare back at it with the confidence of Jesus Christ. I don't know what road you're about to travel. I don't know if you're about ready to walk down your own Calvary where you will have to be disciplined in the art of forgiveness. I don't know if you're about ready to walk down the road, even of Emmaus, where in a time of despair you are longing for hope. I don't know what road you're about to travel. But what I do know is you will be prepared for those roads if you go to the end of the road to Damascus. Because it's in the road, the end of the road to Damascus is where we learn about theology and ethics. The end of the road to Damascus is where we grow in knowledge and in character. The end of the road to Damascus is where we learn about humility and servitude. The end of the road to Damascus is where we learn to live like Jesus so we can be Jesus to those that we lead. I don't know what road you're about to travel. But what I do know is that the end of the road to Damascus is the beginning of a journey. And if that's true, if that is true, then the most important thing that I can say to you right now is, you're dismissed.